onto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Welsh Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake McClure. Did you call it the Welsh? Welsh?
I don't know. I can't hear myself.
Welsh? So, are you Welsh?
No. Well, maybe it is the Personal Welsh
Coach. You can't hear yourself?
No. I can hear you really loudly, but I can't hear me. Just barely hear me. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio show, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does business all over the place, around the country, and so on, but is in the business of offering investment advice, and this show is not investment advice. This show is
educational,
but not intended to be investment advice.
What's the difference? Why is that important? Why do we say that every week?
Educational information is to educate you. Investment advice is for you to take action on. So you should not take specific investment action on the information that we give you here.
Education leads you to making better decisions. Advice is advising you to make a specific decision.
Oh, that's cool.
There we go.
So it's also true that we very carefully research the things we talk about on this radio program. And we get them from sources that we believe are reliable and consistently reliable, but we make no guarantee or warranty as to the accuracy of anything we state here. And we also are not part of Town Square Media or KTEM, and what they think and say and do and what we think and say and do are different things altogether. So we're not responsible for them, nor are they for us, nor are we responsible for any of the commercials that are played on here.
Are we just irresponsible? Is that what you're saying?
You got it.
We're just irresponsible in every direction.
Well, I can tell you that the stock market went up and down during the week and wound up almost exactly where it started.
But there was a lot of fanfare for each day of it doing nothing, basically.
It actually went up and down about something around 2% during the week.
But
it wound up down 0.22%, so it's pretty much where it was. The same thing is true of interest rates. They're pretty much where they were at the beginning of the week, despite all the excitement, despite the fact that at the end of the week, the announcement came that the president was going to sign a bill to reopen the government. As soon as that information came out, the market went up 2%, but it had been down 2% because the Senate had failed to pass a bill to reopen the government. So that's all out there. The fact that it's a temporary reopening, 21 days,
well,
didn't restore a lot of confidence.
Yeah, maybe temporary, maybe permanent. But the fact that they're not even saying it's temporary. They're saying it might be temporary,
which is even worse than
calling it temporary.
No, the bill is for 21 days of funding. That's
right.
It. And then it's over. If they don't do anything, it's over.
Right. And what the president is saying is different than what Congress is saying. And Republicans and Democrats in Congress are saying the government's reopened. We don't want it to be shut down again. And then the president is saying maybe it will be and maybe it won't be.
Well, they have to pass another bill to refund the government past 21 days, and the president has to sign it. And the bottom line to it is that confidence is not restored in the market, so we didn't get a big jump up in the market.
And the other piece of it is that it was the speech on the fact that the government was reopening was supposed to occur in the Rose Garden of the White House at 1:30 Eastern. It didn't actually occur till 2:30 Eastern, which then it went for 30 minutes, and then we only had a very short period of time where the market was still open before close. So it was momentous. It was also late.
Well, it was for the moment, and the crisis isn't over, so the market didn't recover.
Yeah, we don't even know what the crisis is, but there is a crisis. Yeah. We've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoyed the show. I read a disturbing article in the Wall Street Journal last week. According to the article, they're starting to grant no proof of W-2 mortgage approvals and bundling those mortgages into investment vehicles. Are we that stupid as a species to try this again?
Well,
good question.
When you say they, that's the issue. We're not; these are not government-backed Fannie Freddie mortgages. These are there are certain private companies that are indeed granting mortgages in a reckless fashion. But that's one of those things that if you stay out of the banking system, which they are, and you grant it privately, you can grant any kind of mortgage you want to grant. People locally very commonly do these rent-to-own deals, or which is in essence a form of mortgage. It just makes the process of getting the property back very easy because they never transfer the title to the people who are doing the rent-to-own. And it's not greatly different from that. The issue is that if the property is worth enough money and a good appraisal, they do have good appraisals on those properties, then the lender feels like they can foreclose on the property and sell it for more than is owed. They jump on it and don't worry too much about whether the W-2 is there. I think what we've got in that article, and I read that article, is a little bit of alarmism. We are not stupid enough to do the stupid things we did before, I don't think.
Well, not yet. We still remember it too well. It'll happen again. It's just going to be a little bit longer.
Generally speaking, when we have a credit crisis, it's going to be in a section of the credit market that previously was considered to be unassailable and absolutely secure. And we've got a couple of those out there, and there's the potential for crises in those areas down the road. Frankly, there's just not any real bubbles right now. And the mortgages that are being issued in less than quality ways are not being converted into AAA mortgage, collateralized mortgage obligation bonds. So that was a bit of a – that article was a bit of a reach. There's always somebody loaning money to people – who may not be able to pay it back and making a bet that they're going to beat the system.
Yeah, the danger is when it becomes mainstream. The danger is when the majority of banks are making loans without proof of income. There's always this happens regularly. There's always banks making loans that are riskier. There's always banks that are out there and they say we don't need a W-2. But having just bought a house in the last year, and not being from a traditional W-2 background as far as my business owner, self-employed, employee people, the bank is very fuzzy on how to deal with that. So, I mean, they wanted to call my employer, and I was like, all right, here's my cell phone number. You can call me right now. And so the concept is there. That bankers are still paranoid. And there's also a reach for profitability, and banks don't make money unless they're making loans. And anybody that's watching the housing market over the last 6 months, 7 months, has seen a slowdown nationwide. Some of that has to do with mortgage rates rising. Some of that has to do with uncertainty over other things in the market. A lot of it is mortgage rates. A lot of it has to do with commodity prices being higher during that time period. The lumber was expensive, and a lot of things were – there were a lot of headwinds. So when that happens, if it's a little bank and they're looking around and they're saying – or even a bank, a big bank on the edge of profitability, if they're looking around and saying, what can we do to increase profitability? It really looks good to do something stupid and give a lot of loans to people that aren't creditworthy. But any bank that's been around for very long knows that that's a very short-term solution. There's a really ugly analogy that I can use there. It's like wetting the bed to keep yourself warm. It's a temporary fix. It doesn't work for very long.
Okay. Oh, great. It's not widespread. And I was concerned that it's one of those, let's try it. It'll be different this time.
Right. Yeah. Well, as long as there's people like you and us and other bankers that are in the position of looking at that risk, I don't think it's going to be a big one.
And the other thing is, Jake said something very clearly there, and that is he's self-employed, therefore he doesn't have a W-2. So the article could have been about the fact that he, who has a very reliable source of income as a owner of a business that has been in existence for 36 years and been able to pay its bills for 36 years and pay him, but he still doesn't have a W-2. Therefore, somebody gave him a mortgage without him having a W-2. So I think what we've got in that article is a reporter doing a little overreach. Which,
yeah, okay. So we're not blowing the balloon up again.
No, there's bubbles undoubtedly will come. Very frankly, I don't see a lot of bubbles that are going to affect investments at this point. I mean, obviously, there's a huge amount of corporate debt out there, and we're getting discussion this is the highest amount of corporate debt in history, but it's at very, very, very low interest rates. Most of it is at like 2%, and if inflation is above 2%, that's not a threat. That's an advantage. And the other thing is student debt, and I read some very good articles, and I think probably true, that probably 40 to 60% of that student debt is going to have to be forgiven, but that's not on the private investments. There are no private investments there. That's the government.
Yeah. What tends to happen in these banking catastrophes, it's not like they don't repeat. It's not like we can't say, hey, that didn't work last time. Don't do that again. It's dangerous. That's important to remind banks of. That's why they don't immediately repeat the same mistakes. But you, I'm sure, remember the Resolution Trust Corporation. I know Old Baldy does, too. This was savings and loan. It was more corporate or business debt than residential debt. But there was a lot of residential stuff in there. So we went from the credit unions making really bad debt decisions based on political things more than on what's profitable long term and short term political decisions. And that was a bunch of bad decisions. And if you look at each of the decisions, none of them are identical to what took place in the Great Recession and the lead up to that, when the housing and mortgage stupidity happened there. But they share things in common. And if we can focus on the things that they share in common rather than the specifics of whether or not somebody has a W-2 on the mortgage. The specific should be only give loans to people that can afford it. And you would think that would be written somewhere in stone in a bank, written somewhere in stone in a credit union. Most of the credit unions disappeared during that time period. The savings and loans disappeared during that time period. A lot of the credit unions came back. There aren't that many savings and loans left. So if they wrote them in stone, the stone has been used to build another building. It's maybe in a McDonald's somewhere.
And again, okay. Go ahead, caller.
No, I enjoy it. Go ahead.
Well, again, I was just looking at some other versions of that article. The metrics that they pulled off of there was based on the size of the loan versus the income of the person making the loan. And they call those high-risk mortgages. There's 100,000 of them in the United States. Well, when you consider the total number of mortgages in the United States, I mean, that was the deal. It went from 71,000 a few years ago to 100,000, and they said, well, that's risky. But that single metric, and this is what you got to watch out for in the news media. A single metric that the size of the loan versus the person's income, that doesn't tell you a lot. That doesn't tell you hardly anything. For example, if you have an unusually large loan but an unusually low payment, that certainly doesn't blow things out of the water. And a person who has a good, solid job, no other debt at all, and they wind up with a loan that's more than 4.5 times their annual income, that doesn't, again, mean that it's necessarily risky. It just means that you might want to look at that and see the rest of the information, but that metric doesn't give you the rest of the information.
Right. There's some other statistics I'm going to throw out there. They're on the same subject. They're not dealing with the same risk. It's a series of other risks. Across most of California, it is not unusual for cost of housing, whether it be rental or mortgage, to be one half of your income. And if you think about that for a second, how does a mortgage industry that stretches across 50 states and territories, how do they deal with California when they're giving a mortgage? Because if somebody in Texas says, I want to buy a house and the payment's going to be half of my income, that would be considered a high-risk loan. Where then when you look over at California, basically everybody's a high-risk loan because the prices are so much higher there, and the income hasn't come up with the price of the houses. So that's one thing. Another thing, another headwind in the mortgage market, this is part of the reason why there may be some more risky behaviors taking place out there. That it may be something we'll see more of in the future. Well, almost certainly going to see more risky behavior in the future as we get further and further away from the Great Recession, is the tax cut. The tax cut was fantastic. A lot of people got a lot of money back, although it happened generally in small increments per paycheck. But it removed an incentive for the vast majority of people that owned houses were able to deduct the interest on their mortgages. Well, it limited that. If you've got a really expensive house, you've got a very small amount of the interest that you can deduct. If it's above $750,000, then you can't deduct above that value. And on top of that, the standard deduction went up to $24,000 from $12,000, which means unless you have a lot of interest payments and you're doing a lot of charity and you're doing a lot of this's and that's, far more than most people do, then you don't get to deduct your mortgage interest, which means there's less incentive for most people to own a home, which as we look around and see that the housing market has slowed down, well, it's even the playing field. The tax cut even the playing field between rental and ownership a little bit more. It's still, if you're going to live in the same house for a long period of time, it's still a lot better logically, monetarily to own it, because even if you lose money, if you lose equity on the round trip, you didn't lose 100% of what you paid into it, unless the house just fell apart and you didn't have insurance. So expect with these headwinds for some banks that are on the edge of profitability to make some stupid decisions. Bank failures are normal even in time periods when it's not front page news. And it's decisions like the one the Wall Street Journal has pointed out that cause these smaller banks and sometimes larger banks to fail in the middle of decent economic eras. Did that answer the question?
It sure did. Thanks, guys. Yeah. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, always appreciate your calls. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the only bubble that I see out there right now relates to the student debt bubble, and it is one that probably won't pop for a really, really, really long time and doesn't have to pop at all, and that is the government debt. When the government debt is rising, when the federal government debt is rising faster than the economy is growing, and it has been since the tax cut, then we're headed for a brick wall at some point. That's really a simple issue. Now, if that happens during a recession, that is perfectly normal and acceptable. That's one of the things that happens in a recession. One of the things the government is for is to balance us up, make us less recessive so we don't wind up going into a depression, make the recession less severe. So they wind up paying a lot of unemployment tax, a lot of unemployment benefits out. Tax collections go down. Spending goes up. That happens during a recession. That's good. During a boom time,
I'm not sure good would be a good.
It is.
I consider normal. I'm not sure good any more than I consider the last recession to be that great. Even though it's been labeled great,
well,
I didn't think it was that great.
It's good if you need to feed your family and your income has gone down. If you need to, and it's a temporary thing, and you go borrow some money to buy food to feed your family, that's
right.
Good debt.
And
that's what we call good debt, because it hastens the recovery. I mean, this is what we've seen all through history. It hastens the recovery and increases the tax flow long term. But when the government goes out and borrows a lot of money just so and gives it to people so they can just spend more money on consumer goods that are going to wear out very quickly to get a short-term burst in the economy, that's a little scary. But the good news is it's going to be 10 years or so before that particular piper comes due. His bill comes due, and that's one of the things we need to look at 10 years from now, but in the short term, it isn't really something to worry about. Now, the mortgage debt crisis, That was a short-term issue because basically, and it, the problem with it wasn't that there was a lot of debt being issued on subprime homes. That wasn't the issue. As long as the institution that issues the debt has to pay for it, yeah, that's too bad.
Right. It was handing it on to the next several layers. Right. It was trying to diversify the risk, which made them feel like there was no longer risk, period.
And it spread this high level of risk across the entire economic system because it was being repackaged by the brokerage houses, the IPOs, not the brokerage banks.
The investment banks.
It was being repackaged in such a way that junk and garbage looked like AAA debt.
It was even called AAA debt.
And that's where the crossover occurs because the AAA debt goes to stabilize insurance companies and banks and pension funds. And when AAA rated securities suddenly dropped to zero, that creates a major crisis.
And then the question becomes, what is AAA? If that's not AAA and it said it was AAA, what's really AAA? And that was part of the crisis. Confusion over rating agencies being wrong.
And this is the issue. The entire financial system of the world, the entire financial system of your personal life, is run on trust. You trust that the bank, for example, has your money and you can write a check, or the credit card company will not suddenly pull all your credit and leave you unable to go buy things with credit cards. And if both of those things happen, they're both banks, by the way, and if they both happened at the same time, the world would collapse around you.
That's called a credit freeze. And if it's just for you, it's not fun. If it's for everyone, it's really not fun.
And if you believe that that could happen, you would stop spending as much money as you spend, and you would start saving cash and storing cash under your mattress or whatever. And they do that in Russia and other countries. One of the reasons that their economy never quite fully recovers and then it sags back down into nothing is because of the lack of trust. The issue that's going on right now with the government shutdown and the uncertainty over tariffs is rapidly eroding trust.
And there's a parallel I can give, a non-financial parallel, and I think it would be a good one. Trust is important. It's across the board. So we're going to use a medical parallel, and I know that's a really weird step off, but we're going to talk about vaccinations. Vaccinations build a trust in immunity. And the trust in immunity is supposed to be tied into the vaccination. Let me explain that a little bit. As long as the vast majority of the population is getting vaccinated, then people look around and they don't see a threat from the same viruses that you're vaccinating for. So say the measles. When I was a kid, nobody I knew had the measles because the measles vaccine had just come out. And it was being used really, really regularly with a lot of people. So I never knew anybody that had the measles, but we're having measles outbreaks now. Cities like Portland and Seattle are these beautiful, high-priced, high-income locations. If you hear millennials talking about places they want to be, those are names that appear at the top of the list. The Austin, Portland, Seattle, Denver, these are places that people want to go. And there's another thing that's in common there, measles outbreaks. Because there's a bunch of people that don't believe that vaccinations are beneficial because they've looked around and never seen anybody with the measles. And so they're afraid of scary stories like autism, which have been thoroughly debunked by so many different places, but there's still this rumor and this fear around it, so people don't get vaccinated. And lo and behold, there's not an outbreak. And people go, oh, well, then I didn't need to be vaccinated. I'm just scaring my kids and scaring myself by getting this vaccination. Why did I have to do it? And they talk to all their friends about it. And so their friends start saying, hey, we don't need to do this. Nobody's having outbreaks because and Joe down the street didn't have his kids vaccinated and he's never had any problem with it. Well, you get enough people that talk to each other like that, enough people not getting vaccinated, and you get a measles outbreak. And the reality is that the trust that measles won't come back is based on this kind of regulatory authority, kind of a rating agency, if you will, saying, look, all these people are vaccinated, so we've got a safe community. Well, if that CDC or any other, the school district says, hey, you don't have to vaccinate because we haven't had any outbreaks, and we'll just mix you in the pot with the people that are vaccinated and it should be fine. Well, you got problems. You got big problems. You got to shut down whole schools. You got to shut down neighborhoods in this area. This doesn't sound like the same decision-making process as a mortgage, but it is. If a bank out there looks around and says, this is good credit, and hands it off to another bank and says, this is good credit, and you might have unvaccinated loans in there. And if enough banks are doing that and saying it's all right, if a small percentage of these loans are unvaccinated, we'll just keep handing it on to the next people, losing the risk in the crowd. But over time, less and less of those loans are vaccinated. Expect an outbreak. And some of the outbreaks can be really big because those loans go out a lot faster than kids are being born. That's kind of my parallel. Thank you for allowing me the time to talk about vaccinations as if they were mortgages and vice versa.
Makes sense. The economy. Let's talk about the economy for a minute. It was interesting that the president's chief economic advisor, Kevin Hassett, warned that the United States economy may not grow at all in the first quarter. Now, that is certainly fascinating coming out of the administration. But there's something to be noted here and just to be aware of, that it's entirely possible that the first quarter of this year may have 1% or less GDP growth. It doesn't necessarily mean we're headed right into a recession. It does mean that things are slowing down, and it also means that the effect of the tax cut that occurred a year ago has basically worn off. It's one of the, going forward, my guess is probably, barring some events that could take place, we probably got about a year till the next recession. And that is something you shouldn't ignore. You shouldn't react to it by getting out of the market or something like that, because timing just doesn't work. It's that simple. I've studied this over and over again, and everybody who has attempted with a public record to do market timing has something in common. They lose money. They lose money over the people who just stay in. So staying in is a good idea. But it's important to recognize that we are long, long, long overdue for a bear market. And we are long, long, long overdue for a recession, because we've now gone a really long time without one. And one is going to come, maybe next year, maybe at the end of this year, maybe in 2021, I don't know. But the issue is,
we have recessions. They're normal.
Are you ready to ride through one without liquidating your 401k or your IRA or whatever it is you live on? Because liquidating it is a disaster. Trying to bail out of the market because the market is down is selling low, and it will dramatically affect your ability to make money going forward. I've seen so many people do that. The issue is to have an adequate cash reserve or short-term bond reserve, something that's secure, very low volatility, and unlikely to be affected by a market downturn, and have enough money in there, and I would say comfortably, to, if you're in retirement, to weather 18 months of down market without touching your equities, without touching the side of your investment portfolio that is going to be affected by the down market. It's one of those issues that people tend to overlook, and the longer we're in a bull market, the lower people's cash reserves tend to get. And
yeah, it's that vaccination thing again. It's like they, for their own, if you haven't seen a crisis for a while, you forget they exist.
And the irony of it is, the longer we're in a bull market, the more likely a bull market is to occur in the near future.
A bear market is
to occur in the near future, where you're going to need it. But the further in the past the last one gets, so you don't think you're going to need it, it's really important to maintain, particularly if you're in retirement and you're drawing on an investment portfolio, it's really important to recognize you have, either you or whoever it is that you use to maintain your portfolio needs to have an adequate reserve. And by that, I don't mean having a 60-40 bond stock that the 40% bond should count.
That's not reserves.
Because We've got examples in the past where we slipped into a recession and interest rates went up. It happens sometimes, and particularly when you've got the government doing huge amounts of borrowing and distorting the system. So it's important that you not be looking to the bond side of your portfolio to draw from in a down market. There's really no substitute for cash or short-term bonds at this point. And you've probably got some time till it occurs. This is the time to start setting aside money in reserve, spend less. Just that simple. Cut now. This will tend to exacerbate the slowdown in the economy, I know. But I'm saying if you're wise, at this point in time, while the economy is still going strong, is a good time to build up your reserves and build up your savings and do that over the next year or so, and you'll probably be able to weather the next downturn without liquidation and ride through it and come out on the other side smiling like a Cheshire cat. It's an important thing because we're probably
smiling, that means you lose your whole body except your smile?
It's entirely possible, okay. But you get the body back shortly thereafter.
Okay. All right. It grows out of the moon.
And I suspect it's about time to do commercials.
Yes, it is. How did you know?
Prescient.
Amazing. All right. We're going to play some commercials. This is Jake McClure. That guy over there is
Jeff McClure.
And we are the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side of these commercials. If you'd like to join us in the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here on KTEM is 773-1400. Of course, the area code is 254-754-773-1400. If you'd like to talk about or ask about anything to do with economics or the markets or investments or things of that ilk.
All right.
I got some more economic stuff if you're interested.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we follow the Conference Board of Leading Economic Indicators pretty closely, and there's a reason for that. We've never, since they've been doing this, which is since the 1950s, the Conference Board has never failed to predict a recession. They're leading economic indicators. Now, they have predicted several recessions that didn't happen, but they've never been a recession in the many, many years they've been doing this that wasn't preceded by consecutive three months of down LEI indicator.
Now, let me throw in an interjection here just so it doesn't sound like we're saying this is a guarantee. There are some things that have just happened and are in the process of happening that have never been part of the measurement. We haven't ever been in a trade war while this was going on, and we've never had a record long government shutdown of this proportion. I mean, that's why they call it a record. So there are some headwinds that are not part of the normal measuring that happens there. But the parts that they are measuring, now I'm handing it back to you.
Well, in October, the LEI was down, I think, 0.3%, which kind of made people a little bit nervous.
Made us a little nervous.
And yeah. It's part of why the stock market peaked in September and didn't peak again in October. Then in November, it was up a little bit, 0.2%. And we've got December's information, although it's incomplete, and that's one of the more nerve-wracking things. It's down 0.1 in December. Now, that's not three down months in a row. That's two down and one up, and the last two are estimates. And the December estimate has got a big caveat that they didn't have all the information they normally need to do their LEI estimate because the Commerce Department shut down. Now, whether or not the Commerce Department in 21 days is going to get the information back out again, we don't know. We don't know what the GDP was for the fourth quarter. We do normally have the first estimate by now by the Commerce Department. But it's one of those things to watch. In this environment where the risk level is unusually high, the fact that we've had two out of the last 3 months, at least in estimates, of the leading economic indicators down, is we're kind of in a neutral stance. And it's one of those things to continue to watch. We don't know what the future is going to hold. I can say that Europe, where they don't have a government shutdown, is teetering on the edge of recession. Italy has now had two consecutive months of GDP shrinkage, which is a powerful indicator. That is the definition of recession. Now, two consecutive quarters. Germany is going to probably, we don't know at this point, it's going to be really close, though. Germany had, in the third quarter of 2018, Germany actually had a contracting economy. They're probably going to make it into the positive zone in the fourth quarter, but just barely. And that is one of the things that, if you want something to be concerned about, the European Union is suffering from the trade wars and from the emission wars and from overregulation and a host of things, but they're one of our biggest trading partners. If they slip into recession and start sliding downhill, and China's economy continues to decelerate, it's deaccelerate. They're growing at 6-point-something%, but 10 years ago they were growing at double digits. This is one of those things that puts the brakes on our economy, because we do export to China. We do export to Europe, and 12% of our GDP constitutes exports. So if we have had a GDP running along, it's doing very, very well. If the rest of the world slides into recession, it's going to be really hard for the United States not to join them. I know that sounds a little strange, because 70% of our economy is
consumers here.
We just stuff we manufacture here and we sell here and people use up here.
But if we're not growing that fast enough so that it's not making up for the shrinkage elsewhere, mm-hmm. then we can get pulled into a recession just because they're having one.
And I don't want to be excessively overly cautious here. It's just that we have some events, and we normally try to stay out of politics, but in this particular case, whichever party or whichever president is in office, the fact is that there are a couple of events that are coming up that could easily by themselves trigger a recession if the United States' economy is growing at the 1-1.5% rate or the 0% rate that the first quarter looks like, depending on whether you're listening to the president's advisors or the consensus of economists. If we have this slow of a growth rate actually going on in the United States, and Brexit blows up, and the European Union slides into recession, and we get tariffs imposed on March 1st, which they're set to do, to 25% on Chinese goods, and we get another government shutdown, I would say the probabilities of a recession get way over 50% this year. If, on the other hand, if somehow we collectively, politically manage to pull our heads out of the dark place where we've kept them,
it's kind of stinky in there.
We could get a boom. And this is one of those things where pure economics can't do the forecasting anymore, because there's too many political uncertainties.
Well, that's where there's another branch of economics, the behavioral branch, that doesn't deal directly with these statistics as the measurement. It looks at what's being measured in a much more humanistic way to say, all right, we've got some polarization. How do you quantify how easy it is to get a deal done in Washington? How do you put a number on that? You can do it. That's political science. It's definitely a murkier science than even economics. There's some cool theories around it, though. If you've got a government that's willing to work together to do things, you can have great things happen, or you can have really, really horrible things happen. So if you think back, I'm just going to give some comparisons through history of just the last decade and a half or so. When George W. Bush was president, he came in with the House and the Senate were both Republican. And they passed a big tax cut and went to war. Now, both of those were acclaimed by the majority, vast majority of Americans at the time. That's why they got elected. That's why they, approval ratings were high. We got attacked by a terrorist organization. So, of course, we should go and smack the people that did it to us. The long-term implications of unopposed governing is clear, though. If we just had somebody that disagreed for the point of disagreeing, if we had somebody in Washington that that's all they did, is just disagree with everything. We kind of got Rand Paul there, but he agrees with enough things that we don't have that as a check. So we have these opposing parties as our check. And man, it's not comfortable. You know, depending on which party you prefer, you probably really dislike the other party. If you're in the center, you probably dislike both parties. And that's where I tend to fall. I'm looking at both parties and going, what are you guys doing? Just come on, do your jobs. And I think there's a growing number of Americans. It's more than think. There's lots of studies and surveys out there that show there's a growing number of Americans that sit in there, don't like the Republicans, and they don't like the Democrats. Come forward a bit, and you have Barack Obama with a Democrat House and Senate and passed the Affordable Care Act. It didn't come through with a single Republican vote, and it had a lot of problems in it. There were parts of it that were good. I hear the gasping out there from the conservatives. And I said it has a lot of parties in it, or a lot of problems in it. And you hear the gasping out there from the liberals. You can't say it's got problems, and you can't say it doesn't have problems, or somebody's going to be really upset. It was a law like lots of others. It was built by committee. It had some good parts in it. It had a lot of bad parts in it. And usually when you've got people fighting over stuff with some compromise involved, you pass a law and then you fix the parts that don't work. Well, we didn't fix the parts that don't work. We were too busy trying to rip it apart. And the other side was too busy trying to enshrine it as in sainthood somehow. So we've got a law that is... it's got some things that were additive to the economy. The fact that we could have our insurance rates go down, and some it's been long enough people forget that. For the first several years that it existed, insurance rates went down because we had a whole bunch of really healthy kids thrown into the health insurance pool. The kids that are below the age of 25 but above the age of 18 were staying in their parents' insurance. We didn't take the parts that were broken and fix them, though, because we had unopposed parties. Then we have come forward to the president, Donald Trump, who starts with a Republican House and Senate. So they unopposed, no single Democratic vote, passed the Affordable, or not the Affordable Care Act, the Job Cuts and Tax Reform Act.
Job cuts?
The tax cuts and job, it's one of those, the tax cut. They need to get better names of these bills,
right,
so that people can remember.
The Job Cut and Tax Reform Act.
Yeah, cut the jobs, reform the taxes. Anyway, the tax cut. It went through without a single Democratic vote, which means if we get a Democrat in the White House, expect that to be the thing that they're trying to rip up. That's just, you have acrimony there. So I really like to see the checks and balances of opposing government, because when government gets together completely and works together sort of effectively, they pass laws that long-term consequences on the economy are big. The Affordable Care Act, without it being fixed, is a drain on the economy. All you have to do is look at the profitability of the pharmaceutical world, which is skyrocketing. At the same time that insurance rates are going up very, very quickly, we don't have good competition in the insurance market. And that was the whole idea, is you have a competitive marketplace where they can get out there. But there's too many restrictions and not enough restrictions. They're restricted in weird places, and it causes this weird animal that's some kind of Frankensteinian, communist, capitalistic, you take the worst parts of both of them and put them together. Or you have a tax cut that was intended. All of the promises were simplify the tax code. Cut the taxes and simplify the tax code. The tax code got more complex in the middle of this. If you're a business owner, good news just came out in the middle of the government shutdown. The IRS released the rules on how to do your 20% deduction on pass-through income.
If you can get one.
And, man, this is like one of the most golden, beautiful buckets of treasure that can ever be offered to any tax planner, because they have job security forever as long as this tax bill is in place. They're going to get paid lots of money from businesses because it's complex. It is not simple. There's a cap on how much money you can make if you're in certain types of businesses, and then other types of businesses don't have the same cap, but you have a whole series of other things that you have to compare against. It's complex. So we need people to be working across the aisle to simplify. Otherwise, if you've got unopposed, you put in everything you want. nobody's going to stop you on it. So you get a mess that comes out of it. You get the Affordable Care Act and you get the tax cut. There are problems with that tax cut. I've benefited from those problems, but there's still problems.
Yeah, one of the other things about the tax cut, and just bear this in mind without going into the details, the tax cut went into effect at the beginning of last year.
Yeah, beginning of 2018.
The
rules
caused it caused a 22% increase. Well, it was probably half of the 22% increase in corporate earnings for last year. The market, though, is down 7% from when the tax cut took effect. Now, why does that mean? It really means very simply that the experiment, according to the collective wisdom of those who participate in the stock market, is that that didn't work. And we talked about it at the time. We talked about it through most of last year.
Right.
That the tax cut, the idea of at the top of a boom to increase government spending and cut taxes is, according to every economic law,
increase borrowing at the same time. Yeah,
well, because you decrease taxes, you had to dramatically increase your deficit to borrow money so people could spend more money when the economy was reaching saturation. According to every school of economics, every economic analyst, every economist that I read anywhere, was a surefire way to wreck the system. And it was an experiment. It was to say, if we do everything that the economists say not to do and do nothing that they say to do, what will happen? And the experiment is still underway. All the jury is not in yet, so we're waiting to see. But so far,
revenues dropped and spending went up.
For the government,
yeah.
Yes. And it did increase corporate profitability, but this is what happened. Corporations didn't use it to do massive investment because the economy wouldn't support massive investment.
And there's another piece to it, one more piece, that it may have, at the beginning of 2018, supported massive investment. We only got the rules on how much taxes we're going to owe or not owe for 2018 in January of 2019.
Mm.
Can you see a little problem there?
Well,
even if you were set and primed in a small business situation to say, I'm going to get this tax cut, so I'm going to make some expenditures here that I wouldn't normally have.
It did raise the Section 179, which is,
yeah,
you
that's
can
nice.
Invest and write it off the same year. The problem is, no good business is going to invest in something just for the tax cut.
No.
They're going to invest in it because they think it'll make their business more profitable down the road. So if I invest in a piece of machinery that makes me able to manufacture more widgets with less expense,
that's a good investment.
Well, it may be. It may not be. And I get an immediate tax write-off for it, which means I get a tax advantage for investing in it. But I can't find truck drivers. I can't find trucks.
Right.
And the highways are full and the railroads are full. So if I were to double my widget production, I couldn't sell any more widgets. Well, no company that wants to stay in business is going to say, yeah, but I get a tax write-off for investing in this piece of equipment that is not going to make me any money.
Right. And to put it at the simplest term, if you're a farmer and you take your canned green beans to a farmer's market, and that's your marketplace. We're about out of time. And you get a machine that cans a lot faster, you could saturate your marketplace. And if you want to go to another farmer's market, you got to pay for it. So we're about out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, there's a local number, 947-1111, or 1-800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And we do read those. We've got it open right now if you want to throw that in there. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.